Thank you. In a minute, Chris is going to come and talk to us a little bit more about church and family and mental health. Before we do that, let's... Father, firstly, I want to thank you for the good things that you give to us. Thank you that we've been able to give to you a proportion of what you have blessed us with as we brought offerings to you today, whether that's directly through our bank accounts or in the offering bags today. We just want to acknowledge that we love you, that you've given us so much, and that everything that we have belongs to you. We're also aware, as we reflect on life, that at times life can be very difficult and very hard, and at times a very dark place to be. And so we thank you for this Sunday, Lord, and we have an opportunity to think a little bit more together around your word and from some of Chris's experience, Lord, about how we care for one another better, how we care for one another when our minds trouble us, when we find ourselves in dark places. Lord, we want to be a church that is a church that's known for loving one another well. And so our prayer is today that as Chris speaks to us, that by your Spirit, Lord, you come very close to us. Help us, Lord, as we begin this conversation together. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Morning. Can you all hear me? Splendid. So, a bit of an introduction. So, this is not really a sermon. Might be a sermon. Don't know. You tell me at the end. It's 11 o'clock on Sunday morning in Crofton Baptist Church, so we're looking at the Bible. And we're going to have our Bibles open, and thanks to Bemi for reading that passage for us. But this isn't, if you're looking for a great exegesis of 1 Kings 19, then, you know, you might be slightly disappointed. Because we're going to use the passage just to inform our thinking and where we go in terms of our mental health. So we're sort of taking a step back, and we're going to look at mental health as a big social issue. Now, in half an hour, or however long, there is no way we can touch everything. So I apologise in advance because this is going to be, you know, big, broad brush stuff. But I think it's important, and I think it will hopefully get some of our thinking going. The other thing I should say by way of introduction is that we are going to talk, albeit briefly, about suicide. If that is something that, you know, is a bit too close to home, is a bit too difficult, and you want to disappear for a few minutes while we do that, then that is absolutely fine. So I'm here sort of wearing my day job hat. So we talk a lot at church about what we do on Monday morning as opposed to what we do on a Sunday morning. And on Monday mornings, what I do is I'm the chief executive of an organisation called Crossways Community. Crossways Community is based in Kent, and we run residential accommodation for adults with mental health problems, moderate to severe mental health problems. So that is for people often coming out of secure hospitals and often coming out of prison, where they have been caught up in crime, but actually the way that they are, that society is dealing with them, is thought to be better within a mental health rather than within a prison. So that's our main aim. And the other thing we do is that we go into churches, we go to businesses, we do a lot of work in schools around getting people to think about their mental health, getting people to protect themselves about mental health, and just trying to get mental health as part of a conversation, which is what we're trying to do today. Because I'm a very well-trained chief executive, I've brought along some of our magazines. So there are some out there, if you would like to see some photos of what we get up to, and all the good things that God is doing through Crossways, you would be more than welcome. I Understanding mental health then. Where do we begin this sort of journey? Well, let me ask you a question. If I say the word physical health to you, I wonder what comes up in your mind. It's probably pictures similar to this, isn't it? It's healthy, it's people outdoors often, or maybe at the gym, doing really good, healthy things for their body, feeling good about themselves. If I say the words mental health to you, I suspect for many of you, that doesn't have such positive images. I suspect for many of us, that is a negative image, either because we are suffering from poor mental health, or we've seen it, or we've just seen it portrayed. Let me give you some suggestions. Well, firstly, you have the sort of society's view of mental health. So, you know, I have nothing particularly against the Sun, but that is a completely appalling and rubbish headline because it's completely not true. If you, you know, obviously you can read the news such as it is within the headline, and it's the reality is that 1,200 people are not killed by mental patients. In fact, if you have a mental illness, you are much more likely to be the victim of crime, and that is because people who have mental illnesses don't pick up the vibes that those who have strong mental health do, and so they get involved in situations that often lead into crime. But that is a society view, that mentally ill people are dangerous. And then we have the Simpsons, who speak truth into most situations, I find, and I think that is a pretty good example of where most of us are, isn't it? So we have the men in the white coats, we have Homer, you know, frothing at the mouth, in his underpants, being taken away. So all this idea of being out of control, not being in your right mind, of being stupid, of being ridiculed, of society controlling you, is happening there. You have Marge and the kids who are frightened and powerless in the face of this episode. And then you have the sort of little green monster in the top, don't you, who is laughing at it all. And actually, if we're really honest, people who have poor mental health can be a source of fun. You know, let us be honest, we have all been on, you know, we've all sat next to the nutter on the park bench, or the nutter on the bus. It can, you know, if you're in the right mood, it can be amusing. But I suspect those are some of the views that a lot of us have. So when we're talking about mental health, what are we talking about? Well, here's a definition of it. When we're talking about good mental health, what we're talking about is emotional and spiritual resilience, the ability to bounce back, the ability to cope with what life throws at you, which allows us to enjoy life, survive pain, disappointment and sadness. It's a positive sense of well-being and an underlying belief in our own and others' dignity and worth. People who have poor mental health struggle with most or all of that. They are unable, to varying degrees, to enjoy life. They have very little self-esteem and very little... they are unable to have a sense of well-being about their own and others. So how do we view mental ill health? I suspect there are a number of reasons. I suspect some of us, it is frightening. And it's frightening for lots of reasons, isn't it? It's frightening because it is our mind. And not being in control of our mind strikes at the heart of who we are, doesn't it? I think there's a lot of stigma probably around there, isn't there? So people who have mental health problems are different. They are not to be trusted. They are to be avoided. And I suspect, yeah, there's a lot of avoidance. We don't want to talk about it. It's too difficult. It's too scary. And where might it end? But, there are four buts there. But. But we all have mental health. Because mental health in some ways is just the same as physical health. Here we are, a group of 200 or so adults, all in varying degrees of physical health. Some of us feeling pretty good today, some of us got the old twinge, some of us have, you know, got some serious problems. It's just the same of mental health. Some of us are feeling really good about ourselves, really strong and able to cope. Some of us, you know, are having a bad day. Some of us are really down. It's just the same. Mental ill health is happening here just the same as physical health. And the statistics are pretty grim, actually. The two to throw at you are that one in four adults will suffer a mental crisis at some point in their life. And perhaps even more sad is that the latest statistics show that one in 10 children under 14 have a diagnosable mental illness. That's not to say they've been diagnosed or have got any help, but they have a diagnosable mental illness. So that's three in every classroom. That's three in every of your kids' classrooms. Think about statistics, and somewhere like Orpington, is you just say, well, that doesn't happen here, because we're winners, we're copers. But actually, statistics are statistics. And although I'm married to a mathematician, you know, they are true. They do have a story to tell. So mental ill health is happening in your kids' classrooms and your grandchildren's classrooms. It's happening in your office. It's happening with the guys you go down the pub with or the ladies you have lunch with. It's happening right here, right now. People are struggling with poor mental health. But the other but to say is that poor mental health is not a life sentence. Now, people who have mental illness, the vast majority of them get better. And the vast, vast majority live happy, fulfilled lives because there are a fantastic range of treatments now that can help people. So when we talk about somebody being mentally ill, that's not some sort of curse on them forever. It's just part of them. And they would deal with it as they would deal with every other physical illness. So don't think that just because somebody says they've got a mental health problem, that is the end. They're never going to get better. They're always going to be like that, because it's not true. The Bible, when we read the Bible, we meet lots of people who have poor mental health. The Bible probably wouldn't phrase it like that, or doesn't phrase it like that, but that's what's happening. There's Jonah. I mean, he was a bit of a weird guy, wasn't he? I mean, great story. But, you know, all the things that he did in the story we read about him probably says this is a man on the edge. Jeremiah struggled with identity and who he was and with fear. Elijah, we read about, and we'll come back to him in a minute. Legion, who Jesus met, a man, you know, possessed by some dreadful mental illness. And then we see just people on the edge of society that Jesus reaches out to. You know, Zacchaeus, normally portrayed, especially by tall people, as a bit of a, you know, guy to make fun of. But actually, a guy who was lonely and didn't know what to do and did something really quite odd in order to be noticed and to get some help. And then we just have a very simple story, don't we? One of my favourite stories from the Bible. The road to Emmaus, so the people who walk with Jesus after the resurrection and who don't realise they're walking with Jesus, but display anxiety and worry and what is going to happen to us. And in all those situations, we discover that Jesus walks alongside them, has words of comfort, and can reach out to them. So we need to do a bit of remembering. We've said before in church, and we say again now, there is nothing we can do that can make God love us any more or can make God love us any less. God's unfailing love for us is not based on what we do or what we feel. God's love continues however we are. You may have seen in the press that the royal princes and princesses have got involved in mental health, which is brilliant. And, you know, somebody said, you know, Prince Prince William, you know, one day almost certainly will be king. Prince William has a certain status, a certain position. If he got a knock on the head, if he had a mental aberration, if he forgot who he was, he would still be Prince William. He would still be Prince William. Whatever his mind told him, he would still be the same person. Same is true of us. Our minds might tell us things that are different. We may think and feel oddly, but we are still children of God. We are still deeply loved by Him. And sometimes we have to hang on to that in the dark times. So what about recognizing some mental health issues? And here we'll start looking a bit at Elijah. So the passage that Bemi read to us comes after, if you like, Elijah's great moment at Mount Carmel, where God uses him really powerfully and shows his power and defeats the prophets of Baal. So Elijah is coming off this great high, this great moment. And then the passage that we read shows the sort of weeks and months that follow that high. And I think it shows us that mental crises can come to anybody. Elijah was at the top of his game from a human point of view. God was really using him. But he crashed. You know, Elijah was one of God's prophets telling the evil King Ahab and Queen Jezebel and their followers to leave their wicked way and return to God. Baal worship had been exposed as a sham, it really was. And then in the passage we read, we move to Mount Horeb and what looks like a complete crash. Suddenly, the man who stood up to a king and 400 hostile religious leaders now cowers at the threat of Queen Jezebel. And Elijah is scared. Says in verse 3, he was afraid and ran for his life. Jezebel is breathing threats to him. You know, she says, may the gods deal with me if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them, i.e. like one of the dead prophets of Baal. Elijah is scared witless and does a runner. And he does appear to be a broken man, to have given up on life. Goes into the desert, which is always in the Bible a place of testing and death, sits under a broom tree and prays, you know, I've had enough, Lord, take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. He feels that he's tried everything, so, you know, let his life end nobly by the one who gives and takes away life, the Lord. He feels an utter failure. He's exhausted physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and so he falls asleep. And I suppose then Elijah might be given these psychiatrist's couch treatment, you know. This guy, he must be bipolar, someone with tremendous highs and incredible lows. All this take my life business, it's a bit over the top, Elijah. Elijah, you're not really the same person as you were a little while ago when you were at Mount Carmel. Elijah appears to have changed. And I think that goes to the heart of why mental illness can be so scary for us. As we think about that, I just want to spend a couple of moments just naming some of the types of mental illness. I'm not a clinician, this is not a clinical talk, but a lot of these words are used in terms of mental health, and sometimes it's just good to understand it. Now, the three most common types of mental illness are depression, anxiety, and stress. So depression is that inability to enjoy life, to enjoy everyday life that is, to not be able to cope with what is happening in life. Anxiety is the inability to cope with difficulties in life, where everything seems too much. Sometimes we phrase it as people having panic attacks, where the body actually reacts to what the brain is telling it, which is, I cannot cope with this. And then stress, when we feel that life is too much, when if you like, our bodies are racing and pumping the adrenaline, but actually we're not getting anywhere. And we just don't feel able to cope with everyday life. So they're the three most common forms of mental illness. Lots of people suffer from them, all of them treatable in many different ways. Then more serious ones that you might come across, so psychosis, so that's when people start hearing voices, and actually the voice they hear are really nasty and undermining and are saying really horrible things about them and other people. Eating disorders, so anorexia is the one that most of us would have heard of, so that is a physical manifestation of a mental illness. The body says, I am hungry and I am thin, but the brain says, you are fat and therefore you must starve yourself. So it's a mental illness. Personality disorders, so just people whose brains do not work in the way that one would expect, such that their reactions to other people, normally, are very difficult to comprehend and understand. OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, I put that in because we use that, as a sort of short-term phrase, don't we? We talk it when people are being a bit nerdy about things, don't we? We say, oh, he's a bit OCD about Arsenal Football Club, or he's a bit OCD about Star Wars. And actually what we mean is they spend a bit too much time in their bedrooms thinking about that. But actually, people who just really enjoy Star Wars or really enjoy Arsenal Football Club don't have OCD. You know, because they enjoy doing what they are doing. They get pleasure out of it. People have real OCD who feel constrained to act in certain ways, have no happiness. The example I always give here is there's a guy who we house who has multiple disorders, and his OCD comes out in a very simple way, which is that he shuts the door to his flat, he goes to his gate, you know, to go on the bus to work, to his voluntary job, and when he gets to the gate, his brain says, you didn't shut the front door. Now, it happens to us all, doesn't it? So what do? We go back and we just double check, and we shut the front door, and we get to the gate. And it might happen again. You know, sometimes you say, did you really shut the front door? But most of us will just say, yes, I have, and off we go. Well, that doesn't happen to my friend. That voice will say, you didn't shut the front door 20, 30, 40 times. So he's just going up and down. And then, if he can break that and get to work, he might not stay very long because he'll be thinking about whether he shut his front door. So that just means his life is just constrained by that. Holding down a job is impossible. Getting to anything on time is really difficult. Bipolar, so that's what used to be called manic depression. So people have tremendous highs and tremendous lows. So a lot of artistic people. So people like Stephen Fry suffer from bipolar. So when they are at the top of their game, they're amazing, but then they crash and have really low times. And then self-harm, again, sort of a physical manifestation of a mental problem. I am completely out of control in my life, but I can control this. I can control how my body feels. I can control the pain I inflict on my body. So how might we spot some of these signs of poor mental health in ourselves, in our family, in our friends? Now, as I've said, I am not a psychiatrist, so this is not a diagnosis, but there are some things that you might want to look out for. So people who become very irritable and aggressive. People who have no interest in life, who you know, the guy who used to come down the pub with you suddenly just makes excuses and doesn't. People who are tired and tearful. People who have poor mental health very often, almost without exception, find sleep very difficult. In fact, we all know, those of us when we have good mental health, you know, when you wake up, you think about, say, the middle of the night, things are always far worse at 3 a.m, aren't they? But people who have constant poor mental health find sleep very difficult. So they're always tired, which means that they can be quite tearful. They can't cope with what life throws at them. Isolated. I don't mean people who like their own company, that's different, but people who purposely withdraw from life. Who, you know, who always have lunch on their own in the canteen, you know, who stand on their own drinking coffee and don't really want to engage. Poor sleeping, poor eating, talked about. Acting out of character. No, so the affable, relaxed guy suddenly is aggressive and bites your head up when you talk to him. Now, we all have bad days. We all exhibit some of those characteristics some of our time, because that's part of our human nature. But when those characteristics continue and become a habit and become embedded, and when they stop us acting in a normal way, when they stop us making good relationships, when they stop us engaging in life, holding down a job, then actually I think they are signs of poor mental health. And then there can be some verbal signs as well. So the sort of catastrophizing. Here we go again. This always happens to me because I'm like that. If it was going to happen to anyone, it was going to happen to me. So here we go again. I'm stupid. And that might sound like a childish sort of thing, but actually we all think, you know, I should have got that promotion. I should have spotted that in my teenager. I should have remembered to do that. You know, just the idea that we're not quite where we want to be. I'm weak. The reason I feel like this is because I'm not a very strong person. I'm a bit pathetic. And that is why I am not coping. Nobody likes me. You know, again, obviously a big issue amongst teenagers. But actually, you know, we all want to be liked and loved. And if you feel that you're on your own, if you feel that family isn't working very well, if you feel that you're on your own too much, that can be a real trigger as well. And then it's all my fault. So people who take almost anything, any problem in life, in their lives, in someone else's life, in the world, and say, well, it's my fault. You know, that thing that happened over there, oh, I could have done something about it. I could have spoken, I could have prayed harder. It's all my fault. So, again, just some triggers that might help. So, as I said, we're going to talk briefly about suicide. And about suicide in men. Now, if you're enjoying middle age, as I am, then the things that are going to kill me, statistically, so my wife tells me, are cancer, prostate. My dad had prostate cancer, so probably I will get prostate cancer. Or a stroke, or heart disease. They're the three things. If you're over 35, as a bloke, yeah, there are guys, that's what's going to do for us. If you are under 35, as a man, then obviously you don't tend to get those diseases. What you tend to die that are under 35 are more violent things. So you die in car accidents, you die in knifings, but the biggest killer by a country mile of men under 35 is suicide. And that is linked, obviously, nearly without exception, to poor mental health. So, obviously women commit suicide, but they don't commit it to such a great degree under 35. And they, without going into the gory details, they are less successful at it when they do it. So why is that? Why are blokes dying? And they are dying in their thousands every year. One man dies every 2 hours from suicide in Britain, under 35. So that's, you know, that's you and me. That's our children, our grandchildren. And we don't know why, but one of the reasons we think why is because about men do not talk. Men do not express what they feel, and they do not ask for help. Those of you, I was talking to one of my friends who's a GP, and those of you who are GPs will know this. And she says when a bloke comes in for a consultation, a lot of the time they will, you know, do the physical examination, deal with the physical issue, and then as he goes out the door, he'll say something like, while I'm here, doctor, could I talk to you about how I feel? You know, really the last thing he wants to do. Because most men, you know, we would rather stick sharp sticks in our eyes than talk about our feelings and our emotions. You know, the stiff upper lip is alive and well and living in Britain. But that is a rubbish way to behave. It is a rubbish way to behave, because then if we can't express what we feel and we can't express our needs, then we can't get help. If we can't get help, then we're going to be on our own and we're going to end up in a bit of a pit. There's a very sexist, but I'll tell you because you won't tell anyone else, anecdote I'm going to tell you, which is that they did some of these experiments on testing how men and women's brains act. And they had one of those that sort of caps where they sort of see how what brain activity is going on, and they had a group of men and a group of women. And they gave both groups some flat-pack furniture to put up, and they measured the brain activity. And both, you know, obviously their brains were going, they were working out, but the men's, you know, the synapses were firing, this was really exciting, they had an Allen key, they had wood, they probably had one of those belts on, they were happy, you know. And the women were doing it because it needed to be done, but you know. And then they took away the wardrobe, and they just gave them both a sheet of paper and said, here is a problem. You know, here's an emotional problem within your family. Can you discuss it? And the women were discussing it and working out what they could do, and the men are flatlining. You know, I don't know. Can't we go back and just finish off the wardrobe? So looking after ourselves is really important. There are lots of ways in which we can look after ourselves and try and protect ourselves against poor mental health. We can make time for our friends and family. We can be intentional, using our magic word, about building relationships. We can take care of our physical health. There's a huge link between good physical health and good mental health. One psychiatrist said, if I could bottle and sell some physical activity in the fresh air, I could solve the world's mental health problems. You know. So, and I know for some of you, the idea of, you know, kicking a ball around and going for a run is dreadful, but actually, think of other ways you could build your physical health. You know, get off the bus and stop early. Walk up the stairs rather than take the lift. Find some ways to build some physical health, because if your body is working well, that's going to be good for your brain. Enjoy the small things. What do I mean by this? By this I mean, when I, sort of 10, 15 years ago, when I was taking the kids to school, and those of you who do it, this is meant to be a really special time, isn't it? You know, you take the kids to school, and it's lovely, and I didn't do it very often because Joe was at home, but I was always 5 minutes late, and, you know, we were always rushing. And you're taking them, and not only have you got to get them to school, but you've got to do the 7x table as well on the walk there. And of course, your kids don't want to do the 7x table, and they don't want to walk very fast. They want to look at all the small things. They want to say, oh, look, there's a digger, Daddy. There's a red digger. Should we wave at the man who's in the digger? We wave at the man. Oh, what do you think the name of the man in the digger is? Don't know. Mr. Digger. What are 6 sevens? And then we go, oh, there's a snail, Daddy. He's on his own. Do you think he's a sad snail? Don't know. Don't care. Where's Mummy Snail? Well, should we look for Mummy Snail? Don't care. What are 4 sevens? But actually, children have a great innate ability of enjoying small things. And as adults, we lose that. But it's a really good way of protecting your mental health, is to just look back over the day. You know, at the end of the day, and just say, okay, today wasn't perfect. That went wrong. But actually, had a really good cup of coffee with Andrew. That was really nice. And that thing I was worrying about, it didn't happen. So that was really good. And, you know, I've just seen a very good, you know, bit of telly, and I really enjoyed that. So enjoy small things, because then we are more grateful. Helping somebody out, really good way to look after yourself, because if you help somebody out, we are no longer a victim. We are volunteers. So if you're giving out, if you're helping, then that's a really good way of making your mental health stronger. Eat and sleep well, we've talked about. Take responsibility. You know, your mental health, our mental health, doesn't happen by accident. In the same way as we look after our physical health, we need to look after our mental health. And then the more difficult thing, about admit when we're struggling. And I know that's difficult. I know that most of us do not want to do that. But we have to, in a church, find ways of doing that. We have to find people we can talk to. And I don't mean the sort of cliched, are you all right, yes I'm all right, are you really all right conversation. We have to find ways, we have to build networks. Now for most of us that's going to be with our in our families. Sometimes, however, it is helpful to have a conversation as well with somebody outside your family. But how does God respond to Elijah? How does God look after Elijah? I wonder, you know, how you and I would have reacted if we'd met Elijah when he was in this state at Mount Horeb. I suspect we'd have used a whole range of terms. You know, he's cracked, he's away with the fairies, to perhaps the rather more genteel, he's having trouble with his nerves. I suspect most of us would have steered clear of him and really hoped he wasn't in our home group. Because that can be the case in church sometimes, can't it? Because as Christians, we live every day in the light of all the amazing things that God's done for us and the amazing grace we've received. The trouble is, that's not how many of us feel all of the time. And our church needs to be a place where it is okay not to be okay. Where actually bumbling along and having bad days is what we're all doing. It's just that some of us are much better at coping with it, and a lot of us are much better at pretending we're okay. So we need to find a place where those who struggle with mental ill health can find acceptance and realization that the condition is quite normal. Where they can receive friendship, and where we can pray for their healing. Because how does God respond to Elijah? Does he rebuke him? Does he say, come on, you know, pull yourself together. Let's get some of that Mount Carmel spirit back again. No. He deals with him very tenderly, doesn't he? There's a great gentleness in that passage. He deals with him individually. Doesn't say, oh, well, come to a big class and we'll talk about it. Deals with him very personally. Deals with him really, really patiently. Gives him plenty of time, days and days, before God says, I think you're ready to move on. And deals with him really practically, provides food and some comfort. And sometimes that's all we need to do, or what we need to do, for those who struggle with poor mental health. What can we do to be a good friend and a welcoming church? Well, we can say something. Almost anything is good. If you think somebody is struggling, then we need to quote the phrase, we need to lean in and say something. We need to listen, and some of us are better at listening than others. Some of us must want to fix. Sometimes fixing is good, but listening is not what we need, is normally what we need to do. We need to reassure. Reassure them of God's love for them. Reassure them that you're not going to go away, that you're going to try and help them. We keep in touch. And if you're one of these people, a man, who doesn't want to talk about it, you know, texting is great these days. You can just ping someone a text saying, you okay? You seemed a bit quiet. You know, I've heard you lost your job. Do you want to meet up for a coffee? We can be honest. We can be honest about how we feel and the difficult times we go through. And we can be normal. Realise for many of us that is quite difficult. But we can be normal. We don't have to go into sort of Christian mode. We don't have to use different words. We don't have to try and fix it. Sometimes, you know, people have mental ill health. Just want to talk about the football or talk about what was on the telly. You know, you just need to have a normal conversation. And sometimes you might need to consider action. That could be a range of things, but I think the vast majority of us who want to help those who are going through difficult times are just going to be saying, let's talk. Let's talk about how you feel. What could we say? What could we say to people that would be sensitive and kind? Well, I'm listening. And listen well and reflect back, you know, say things like, I think what you're saying is, have I understood this correctly? I'm praying. We have an amazing God and we can bring everything before him. I don't know how you feel. Now, you may do, if you've got some lived experience of mental ill health, you may be able to say, yes, I've been through something similar, and that is brilliant. But for a lot of us, we'll be saying, I don't know how you feel, help me to understand. Let's not pretend that we feel different than we are. Can I help? Can I help in a practical way? You know, do you need me to go and get your medication? Do you want me to come, you know, come with you to the GP? Do you just want to come round for a bite to eat? Should we go out? Do you just need to get out of the house? Go for a walk? Do you need a hand with something? And then very importantly, remember the good times. One of the things that often happens with people who have poor mental health is that they find it difficult to focus on good things. So it's really good to remind them of, do you remember that great time we had when? Or, I saw your son in church today. Wow, isn't he doing really well? Reminding them of good times is another way to build people's resilience and to build up their strength. So how does God restore Elijah? He is not silent. God is not silent when he sees people in distress. He leans in, he deals. He focuses on him. And in a busy world, and we're all busy, that's very difficult. He focuses on him. He touches him supernaturally and restores him. And then he gives him this really important task to go off and talk to some of the other leaders. Doesn't write him off and say, oh, right, Elijah, he's off the list for useful people. People who have mental ill health are able to contribute in the same way as everybody else. And when God touches him supernaturally, how does he touch him? Well, it's there in that gentle whisper, isn't it? That still, small voice that God speaks to Elijah. It's the voice of God speaking to him. When that voice speaks, it doesn't boom. I think what God is trying to say to Elijah and us is, the way I make a real difference in the lives of people, especially those who struggle with broken minds, is by my Holy Spirit, by that gentle whisper coming through. And that's how God starts to restore people, gently, quietly, positively, and yes, perhaps unspectacularly. God's care of Elijah shows us that the still small voice is often how God speaks to us, whatever our situation, but especially when we're feeling down and depressed and disheartened. There are many people in our families, in our churches, in our communities, in your workplaces, for whom, like Elijah, the journey is too much. And people going through difficult mental health issues are not often rational or kind or grateful or welcoming. They often feel very different to us, but they are not. They are not. They are loved children of God, made in the image of their Creator, just like you and me. We need to make sure that when we come alongside people who are having mental difficulties, that we are also part of that still, small voice, quiet, clear, certain, and Christ-centered. Because that's how Jesus spoke to all the people he met who were going through difficult times, with love and compassion and quietness. If we need more help, where else could we go? Now, for most people, we can go to our family and our friends, and they will be really good people to help us. Our GPs are really good. There's a lot of money and training gone into GPs, and they are very good now at dealing with mental health problems. Some of you will have counsellors. Our church family, there are people in our church family who would be very happy to talk to you if you have a mental health problem or if you think someone in your family might have. There are a range of people, people like Carita and June Judd and Bernadette and myself and others I know who work in a mental health setting who would be very happy to share with you. there are people in our congregation who have lived experience of mental health. And that can be very rich and helpful as well, as they explain some of their difficulties and how they have coped. There's a few organisations. You might be, Mind and Soul Foundation are sort of the big Christian mental health charity. Some brilliant work they do. Samaritans and Mind are two big mental health charities that have really good resources on their websites. And Young Minds for teenagers and parents, very good. Some good stuff there about how to have conversations with your teenagers if you are concerned. My soul is downcast within me. Yet I call this to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. We are not consumed. Why? For his compassions never fail. Ultimately, we worship that same great God who was with Elijah through all those difficult times. That same great God who we know heals broken limbs and broken hearts and broken marriages. That same God can heal broken minds as well. Amen. We're going to